Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
New Books Network and your host, Nathan Moore. Welcome Thomas L. Murray Jr. to a podcast episode about his book, Making Nice with Naughty, an intimacy guide for the rule-following, organized, perfectionist, practical, and color-within-the-line types. Murray is a forensic sexologist, sex therapy supervisor, educator, and author. He attended Bloomsburg University of Pennsylvania and obtained his PhD from the University of Florida. Dr. Murray's passion is in sex, couple, and family counseling, and focuses now primarily on clinical studies of sexuality in humans. Before that, he was in public education. Dr. Murray, give your audience a better picture of your shift towards sex therapy and what else about your background makes you the right person to get advice from.
Well, thank you for having me on your show. It's really an honor. I started out in higher education in student affairs, working as a counseling center director at a major performing arts conservatory here in North Carolina. But a dream of mine was to really delve into sex therapy. I was one of those kids that often people would talk to about their sex lives. Now, in retrospect, pretty inappropriately, but it was a kind of a moth to a flame with people talking to me about their sex life. And so I had this dream of eventually pursuing sex therapy as a training. And in 2015, I became certified as a sex therapist through the American Association of Sex Educators, Counselors, and Therapists, which is the premier body of for credentialing sexual health professionals. I get this question of kind of what's prepared me most to become the therapist that I am today. And I often say because I had 18 years of apprenticeship, also known as childhood. My family background certainly had an influence, but, many people along the way have added to my understanding of the human condition, which I'm quite grateful for.
When did you start writing your book, Making Nice with Naughty? And what, if anything, inspired you to take up the topic?
I started writing Making Nice with Naughty in the fall of 21. And it was, it's been a lingering idea, especially the title. I have played with that title for some time and had thought about different ways of writing the book. But in 2021, I became a Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Business Scholar. And through that experience, my business coach really encouraged me to put pen to paper, if you will, and start writing Making Nice with Naughty. what the topic really shifted to was a reflection of my work with individuals and couples who are so rules oriented. They're so driven to do what's right. They're risk averse, threat sensitive, rejection sensitive, what we typically call over-controlled or having too much self-control, which is in many ways a virtue. However, when it does become a problem, it typically shows up in one's sex life and intimate relationships. And so making nice with naughty is really about making nice with this part of you that's a rule breaker, that's a discoverer, that's an experimenter, reclaiming that kind of curiosity that is innate, especially among younger people. And if you can make nice with that naughty part, you get to experience a much more fulfilling sex life.
What is your thesis then in your book, Making Nice with Naughty, and why should we care?
A lot of people report, and one of the most common complaints that any sex therapist sees, including me, is that people no longer have desire, right? They may have lower sexual desire than their partner. And I have found in my work that for some of these people, part of the low sexual desire is that they have lost that playfulness, that spark, that fire of desire. And so making nice with naughty is really offering a way to understand this over-controlled temperament and its virtues, as I mentioned before, but also how it can negatively impact people's sex life. So, this book was written particularly for those people with the over-controlled temperament, or like I said, another way of referring to it is that too much self-control, where they're very rule-oriented, and helping them to see that there is another way that they can have more aliveness in their relationships and sex life by turning down the volume on that over-controlledness, knowing though that they'll never be under controlled. We're kind of biotemperamentally programmed to be over controlled if you're over controlled. And by the way, I, as I talk about in the book, I identify as over controlled as does most therapists, and particularly anybody who goes to graduate school. Being over controlled is almost a prerequisite to getting through graduate school. But it can show up as problems in people's sex lives, and that's certainly what I've seen in my practice.
Describe your psychotherapy practice for us, and what psychological methods are you employing in this book?
Yeah, so I've been informed by many different psychotherapeutic approaches. As you may know, there are well over 450 different types of psychotherapy models. And what I've mostly pivoted my practice towards is really a style, and I call it the carefrontational style. So when people come to see me, they're hiring me primarily because they want me to be an advocate for their relationship. They're really concerned about the vulnerability of their relationship, and so when they hire me, I'm going to speak on behalf of that relationship. I'm going to be a champion for them. And so I euphemistically say, I'm straight to the point, no beating around the bush, and occasional karate chop to the throat, if that's what's needed in order to get their attention about what is in the best interest of their relationship. And so I endeavor to never be on any individual side, but only on the side of the relationship. Now, kind of the academic part of that answer is the influences of radically open dialectical behavior therapy, rational emotive behavior therapy, as well as Buddhist contemplative psychology are all elements that have impacted my work and are reflected in the book Making Nice with Naughty, as well as other secular writers such as Byron Katie and Eckhart Tolle. I use some of that information to help people get a clear understanding of how their mind works, and then to kind of life hack their mind, if you will, as they move into pursuing making nice with Naughty.
And why is the OC temperament so integral to your research?
It is a common theme that I see among clients who come into my practice. So that OC, or the over-controlled temperament, again, you know, I talk about it as if I'm not one of them. But a common feature of the over-controlled people is that we get a lot of positive feedback from the world. The world tells us that we're accomplished, that we're hardworking, that we're dedicated, and so the world gives us a lot of great feedback. And then there can be this psychological distress, really, that their private lives don't match this public persona. In fact, many OC people will go to great lengths to hide their inner distress or anxiety or depression. In fact, if an anxious or depressed OC person's out and about in public and someone asks them how they're doing, one of their favorite F words is fine. You know, I'm doing fine. People don't really show much vulnerability. OC people don't show much vulnerability. The goal, I think, of the work is to educate people about how this OC temperament shows up in their life and is causing problems for them. I just had a couple the other day where I explained to him about the OC temperament. He's a physician, and he was really locked into this experience of being seen, that wow, this really explains a lot of why I have some difficulties in my interpersonal relationships if I'm criticizing or constantly emotionally unavailable to my partner, etc. So helping people to understand the OC temperament and its impact on this important part of their life is really important.
And does your book have value in academia? You teach mental health courses in places like Northwestern University and elsewhere.
Yeah, so my book is the first the first book to use this concept of the OC temperament that was originated, again, out of the research of Thomas Lynch, who is the developer of the radically open dialectical behavior therapy. So there are no books written for the popular press on RODBT or the application of RODBT to any particular issue other than mine. And so there's a lot of the research in academia around the OC temperament and the use of RODBT has mostly focused on anorexia. Some of your listeners may know, anorexia is this very rule-oriented, restricted eating, this drive towards perfectionism. These are all exaggerated features of the OC temperament. And so most of the research has been focused on conditions such as anorexia, as well as obsessive compulsive personality disorder, which should not be confused with obsessive compulsive disorder. This OCPD, again, is another exaggerated form of the OC temperament. And so we're seeing a little bit more research in that area. But, you know, if we think about it, again, my focus on my book is about sex and intimacy, and that already is a very vulnerable topic, and particularly vulnerable to OC people. And academicians tend to lean towards the over-controlled temperament. So it's no surprise that academia has yet to really grab on to studying the impact of the OC temperament on human sexuality.
Did you do research in archives or with interviews? What was your research process like on this?
Fortunately, it's been my direct experience with my patients over the past, I guess now, in my eighth year as a sex therapist, of seeing the of these patterns emerging, and then using the frame of radically open dialectical behavior therapy to understand the nature of the OC temperament. And so the data are coming directly from my patients.
So are there social patterns that you're seeing in individuals who may benefit from the ideas in your book? And then from your personal experience, what's been the demographic age or personality type of people who are not enjoying sex?
Yeah, so if I'm understanding your question, let me just kind of go back and share a pivotal moment in my work with patients that certainly helped to clarify the thesis of the book. One session, this is the height of the pandemic, and so this would have been around September of 2020. I had doing telehealth, as most therapists were at that time, and was working with a couple who had some young children. And as is often the case with a lot of couples with young children, there's this decline in interest in sex by one or both partners. And I had this kind of light bulb moment that I bet I could predict the quality of a couple's sex life by just asking one question. Are you a be careful parent or are you a have fun parent? In other words, when your child's about to take a risk on the playground, is your impulse to yell, be careful, or is your impulse to encourage the exploration and in the adventure through a have fun? And what I found is that the be careful parents tended to report sexual problems in their relationship. And the have fun parents were the ones who were less likely to report sexual problems. They may have had other problems, but their sex life wasn't it. And so when I think of this kind of social patterns, you know, it's really these people who are, again, risk averse, threat sensitive, rejection sensitive. They have strong feelings about how the world should be, must be, and has to be. In fact, if the world doesn't comport to what their expectations are, one of their other favorite F words is frustrating. So they'll often say, this is frustrating, or I'm frustrated. And so that can impede their connections with others. You know, a lot of OCs, what they fear most is uncertainty. So they tend to plan, they tend to be very future-oriented, and as a consequence, tend to lean towards more anxiety than others. And so that also kind of points to the demographics of this population, particularly their personality type that is being over-controlled. I should mention that, you know, the over-controlled temperament is like any other temperament, you know, be it introversion, extroversion. You know, temperaments are neither good nor bad, right nor wrong, but are just stable ways of showing up in the world. And so the over-controlled temperament is, you know, it's just a style of being in the world. And of course, that is the focus of the book. That demographic age is mostly going to be of interest to you know, people in their mid-20s and older who are either in relationships or had troubled relationships where sexual issues were a problem. And you know, sexual issues can include things like premature or ejaculation, or also known as rapid ejaculation, delayed ejaculation, erectile dysfunction, or what I euphemistically call erectile disappointment, in that, you know, these people don't have difficulty getting an erection when they're by themselves. They may just struggle with it with partners. And so we can look beyond the curtain and see that for a lot of people that this book is written for have some form of what's called sexual perfectionism. And that is, they have this strong belief that they have to be sexually perfect, or their partner has to be sexually perfect, or they think their partner thinks they have to be sexually perfect. And then the last form of sexual perfectionism is this belief that society expects me to be sexually perfect. So it kind of gives you a flavor of the personality type and demographic age who would be most interested.
And how are men and women expressing themselves differently? Is gender a factor here?
It certainly is. Of course, gender doesn't exist in isolation. Gender is certainly highly influenced by cultural factors as well. And so we can look at things like sexual perfectionism, as I just described, this pressure to be sexually perfect by society can particularly be impactful to women. It certainly can impact men too, but in different ways. For example, I find that men are some of the least likely to do any reading about human sexuality. And I think that there's this general assumption that men in particular should know everything there is to know about sex right out of the gate. And therefore, there's almost this, I don't know if you're familiar with the concept of stereotype threat, I don't want to admit that I don't know something. And so I think that impacts men differently. For example, a lot of men develop phobic reactions or anxiety disorders after not getting an erection when they thought that they should get one. And so they then start to anticipate sexual problems in the future, which then activates adrenaline in the body. And of course, adrenaline is a vasal constrictor and impedes erectile functioning. And so the very fear response makes it more likely that they'll have erectile problems. So I do see it differently. But what's common among men and women, particularly who are over controlled, is those features that I described earlier.
What parts of your sex therapy go beyond the mental and focus on the physical body?
I see. Yeah, so that's a great question. If let's say someone comes in who has vaginal pain during penetrative sex, and of course I'm a sex therapist who is licensed to work with the mind, so I don't touch my patients. At the same time, there are important interventions that might include touch. So I will refer patients with vaginal pain during penetration to a pelvic floor specialist who's a physical therapist who has specialized training, and collaborate with them to help to reduce the discomfort that one might experience during sex. If someone is overweight and is having erectile difficulties, then certainly helping them in a diet and exercise regimen that will improve their overall health can certainly improve erectile functioning as well. Same is true for rapid ejaculation. You know, the more cardiovascular health you have, the less likely you can increase one's stamina through increasing one's cardiovascular health. Yoga is a similar intervention that helps to quiet the mind through physical postures. And one key piece of that, of course, is deep breathing, being very attuned to one's breath, and coming into the present moment through physical stretches and what have you. And all of that are different ways of recentering the mind and the body. And as you're kind of alluding to, there, what I say about sex is sex is like honey. No matter how much you read about honey, you do research on honey, you look under the microscope at honey, you can do dissertations on honey, but you'll never know what honey tastes like until you taste it. And so there are certainly instances where having the experience is way more important than sitting on my couch and talking with me.
Why perfectionism? Is perfectionism what is preventing people from opening up, or is it something else?
Well, perfectionism is a solution to a fear or discomfort around vulnerability. So perfectionism is think about it as a solution for what people believe is necessary to avoid rejection. And so people who lean towards perfectionism believe that I have to be perfect so that I can be acceptable. That of course is a impossible goal and can really distance people from others. There's a concept in social psychology called the pratfall effect, which simply means that our imperfections are precisely what make us more endearing to others. But that's hard for people to believe. They think, oh, if I'm perfect, then why would people reject me? When in fact, our perfectionism, if we strive for it, gives the impression to others that we're somewhat untouchable. When you're more interested in being perfect, you're less interested in actually having an authentic connection with others, and that sense that, you know, people can sense that and inadvertently then distance themselves from you.
And do you include fetishes in your book? And if so, what are some of the kinks that you mention?
That's a great question. It's not a major topic in the book. In part, you know, these are fetishes for a lot of people can feel too on the margins, particularly for over-controlled people. That isn't to say, however, that over-controlled people do not engage in fetishes. In fact, many of them do. They do so with great privacy and secrecy around their fetishes. They may experience shame and embarrassment around their fetishes, even though most people experience some particular sexual interest that may be considered out of the norm. What we do know about kink, and I do talk about BDSM in the book, now that I'm recalling. These are ways of being playful. These are ways of kind of making nice with naughty, befriending naughty, if you will, and in having mystery integrated into one's sexual experience. And, you know, the reality is we are all sexual beings 24/7. So we're never not sexual beings. But I think a lot of people have been made to feel quite self-conscious about their sexual expression, and therefore any of these kinds of behaviors then get shuttered away rather than celebrated. And certainly, anything that two consenting adults or more are doing together that aren't violating the rights of others, and that is mutually beneficial and pleasurable. As they say in the sex therapy field, don't yuck someone else's yum.
And what about the metaphorical ego tug of war that you write about? What are some methods to win that tug of war?
Well, the ego, as I explain in the book, is not the ego that Freud talked about. The ego that I'm referring to is more of the ego that the Buddhists describe, which is that inner voice, that narrator of your life. All of the conditioned, what we call conditioned parts of who you are, or your domestication. The listeners, we've all been domesticated by our families, by society, and that influences this inner voice. And often that inner voice can make you or persuade you to do things, particularly out of anxiety. A big part of the work that I do is to help people to understand their own mind, their own ego, so that they don't have to take it so seriously. And so, as you know, if you've ever played tug of war, one of the ways to release the tension is to let go of the rope. And so, in essence, the metaphorical tug of war, letting go of the ego, is to be a better observer of the mind rather than a participant in the workings of the mind. So I can observe my own mind chatter. I don't believe, or I don't see myself as the mind chatter. And once you have that separation, that you realize, oh yeah, I'm no longer this voice in my head, but I am the observer of that voice, then it's less persuasive, it's less seductive, and then you can be directing your behavior towards those things that better reflect your values.
And for people on the LGBTQ spectrum, are there different strategies that you employ?
You know, as someone who identifies as queer, it just is refreshing, to be honest, how common these issues that I see in my office are reflective among all peoples in relationships, that these are just common issues. Now, of course, there are, I think as time has gone by over the past 10 years or so, particularly before marriage equality, I think there was a lot more kind of disparity between LGBT folk and heterosexual people. But I think, the lines are becoming more and more blurred. And so I'm sensitive, of course, to the various oppressions that people within the LGBT community experience, that people who live heterosexual lives may not experience, and tie that into my work. But I want to underscore that I think there's a lot more similarities than there are differences.
Do you recommend people write down their improvements and losses, say, like in a notebook?
Can you say more about what you're referring to?
Well, from your practice and people that come to visit you, would you recommend that they record some of their feelings or sexual intimacy experiences to maybe learn more about themselves in a notebook or journal?
Yeah, you know, journaling is an excellent way of memorializing, if you will, the workings of the mind. And so in many ways, you can find insight through reflections. What I would caution anyone, particularly people who are over controlled, is to be on guard for any part of you that feels like, oh, I have to do something, I should do something, I must do something, because these are just more rules. And so if someone finds it beneficial to journal and to write down their experiences, then ultimately that's what matters the most. You know, as a sex therapist or as a therapist in general, I don't give a lot of homework. I don't prescribe a lot of homework, in part because, again, the type of client that I'm seeing with the over-controlled temperament, they're the ones that are going to hyper-focus on the details of the assignment. They're going to be concerned about doing the assignment correctly. They don't want to disappoint. And so that's just is more of the same dynamics that are bringing them into the practice. I'm much more interested in them doing things spontaneously, being playful, leaning into anxiety, discovering new parts of themselves in kind of more unconventional ways.
Why are there risks inherent in monogamy? Are you recommending other options?
Those are great questions. One of the major risks of monogamy, let me just say, you know, monogamy kind of culturally is said to be the gold standard of relationshiping, and it's a fine institution. But because we elevate it culturally to such a high level, there isn't discussion about the inherent risk associated with it. And one of the major inherent risks associated with monogamy is the decrease of desire over time. And so empirically, we know that on average, a couple in a long-term monogamous relationship experiences a reduction in lusting after each other about 8% per year. And liking their partner declines on average 4% per year. And so those things aren't talked about, right? The assumption is, hey, monogamy is a way to keep the flames of desire alive, when in fact, the research doesn't support that monogamy as an institution itself is sufficient for maintaining it. And so I spend some time at length with my couples around this concept of monogamy and helping them to kind of be more explicit and conscious of the implications of having chosen monogamy as their governing institution for their relationship. As to whether I recommend other options, I don't have a particular leaning towards one option or another. All the options have a set of benefits and risks associated with them. And, you know, everybody has to decide which set of pros and cons they're willing to live with.
Are intimacy and love the same as sex?
You know, that's a wonderful question. Of course, you know, I think poets and artists and musicians, as well as academicians, have been trying to define those terms for millennia. You know, for me, as I describe in my book, intimacy is high risk, high anxiety, low predictability, newness, and novelty. Contrast that with closeness. Even though most people use closeness and intimacy interchangeably, they are different. So again, intimacy is high risk, high anxiety, low predictability, newness, novelty. Closeness is low risk, low anxiety, high predictability, comfort, familiarity, right? And so what happens for a lot of the people that I see, their relationship has become over-concentrated with closeness at the expense of intimacy, and that's an impediment to desire and passion, etc. Now, love, to give a little history, comes from the old English word lief, L-I-E-F, which eventually became the word leave, as in I give you leave. And then leave turned into love. And this, so if we look at the essence of love, love is about acceptance. So I accept you as you want to be. Where a lot of couples get into trouble is they want to love the other person with an agenda, which is I want you to be as I want you to be. But real love is I want you to be as you want you to be. Or in other words, I want to accept you as you are. And so real love to me is embodies acceptance. And that is hard. That's hard to do. We all want to be loved unconditionally without much reflection on how difficult it is to love others unconditionally. And so they are certainly not the same as sex. Sex is... really an activity between people that can be devoid of either one of those things, intimacy and love.
So you have different books, You have different exercises for couples that are inside of your book. Can you recommend some of those exercises for the audience who is listening to maybe do? Can you explain one?
Yes. So one of those is looking at your values. Values are kind of the light posts lighthouses that help to guide your behavior. And so if a couple values a physical affection, for example, or they value having a conversation with each other, but their behaviors aren't consistent, meaning they're not showing up in a way that would provide the evidence that those values are important, then the couple is encouraged to write out those values. There's an exercise in there about identifying what those values are. And then identifying which behaviors that they would be doing that would reflect those values. And we call those behaviors the turning toward moves. So a turning away move would be kind of the silent treatment. I doubt that anybody would write that their values are to be emotionally avoidant. But a lot of people find that when they're in conflict, they engage in the silent treatment. And so the exercise is to help couples get really clear about what's important to them relative to their marriage, and then choose behaviors that are consistent with what's important.
What are the most common reasons that people come to see you at your practice, And would you ever turn someone away?
As I mentioned earlier, the most common reasons that people come to see me are they're having sexual issues or they're having marital issues. My practice is really almost exclusively focused on those two main presenting problems. And so whether I would turn someone away, it's rare that I would do that. I may divert them to other services. So, for example, I'm also a what's called a discernment counselor. And discernment counseling is a type of conversation between people who are on who may be on the brink of divorce. And so and they're trying to figure out kind of which path to take. They're ambivalent about divorce and they want clarity or certainty. Well, if a couple comes in saying that they want couples therapy, when in fact they're quite ambivalent about remaining married, then couples therapy is just not for them. Couples therapy is designed specifically for people who are both leaning into the marriage, that they're really invested in and owning their own contributions to the problems and working on themselves relative to the relationship and wanting to improve the relationship. And so if a couple is ambivalent about that, then I'm not going to offer them couples therapy, but rather redirect them to a different service called discernment counseling. Also, I would say, you know, because of my style as being, again, direct, to the point, an advocate for the relationship, if someone has more of a poor me, kind of a victim consciousness, who wants to just blame their partner for all of the problems in their relationship, they're just not going to resonate with me. And so I will help them move to maybe another provider, either within the practice or in the community, who may be the more touchy-feely, how do you feel about that kind of therapist that I'm certainly not.
What is rational emotive behavior therapy, or REBT?
So rational emotive behavior therapy was developed by a psychologist, Albert Ellis, in the 40s and 50s. And 1940s and 50s. And he initially trained as a psychoanalyst, as did most mental health people in that era. But he found that it just wasn't effective. And he took application, if you will, from the ancient philosophers, namely the Stoics, who understood, you know, 2,000 plus years ago, that most of the problems that we experience aren't from the actual distressing events in our lives, but rather from how we evaluate those events. For example, if one's driving down the road, let's say someone goes to a therapist because they have road rage, and they say, "I get road rage because people cut in front of me, and that makes me so angry when people cut in front of me." Well, if we were to diagram what really happens, what we see isn't that they're upset because someone cut in front of them, but rather they're upset because of the thoughts that they have about people cutting in front of them. You know, their mind chatter or their ego will say things like, that isn't right, that isn't fair, they should get into trouble, they should be punished, all of this kind of inner dialogue that occurs. And those thoughts fuel the rage. It isn't the actual event. And how do we know that? Because if we had 100 people who had someone cut in front of them, we wouldn't get universal responses from all 100 people, that there's some other factor at play. And what our rational emotive behavior therapy essentially is getting at is that how you view the experience is either going to work for you or not work for you. It's either going to be adaptive or maladaptive. And when people experience maladaptive reactions, and that being defined as you're not living consistently with their values, then we want to offer alternative ways of thinking that are much more adaptive. And so rational emotive behavior therapy falls under that umbrella of what's called cognitive behavior therapy, that takes a look at what thoughts are wreaking havoc in your lives.
Do you have any thoughts or experiences on risk versus reward when it comes to intimacy?
Well, namely the risk, right? You know, again, as over-controlled people, they tend to be very risk adverse, in part because they want absolute certainty of the outcome of their actions. That can be much more persuasive than reward. In fact, over-controlled people tend to have low reward sensitivity. In other words, they're not all that motivated for rewards. You know, for example, sex feels good. You would think that people would want to have more sex, but what we find is that over-controlled people aren't persuaded or motivated to have more sex just because it feels good. They are easily distracted, if you will, by stressors that might be, you know, out there. You know, is there? Let's say one is having sex in a hotel room, and they hear people walking down the hall. That, you know, the over-controlled person may not want to have sex because they are afraid of getting caught, right? Or I remember, just to be personal, one time I was at a sex therapy conference, and one of the sex therapy attendees and I, you know, decided we were going to go back to her hotel room, and she's like, would you like to have, you know, let's have sex on the balcony. And I was like, I was willing. And so she opened up the curtains, and it was lit like the 4th of July. And I was like, you know, that's not going to happen. Right. So I'm not willing to take that kind of risk, even if the reward would have been great. And so for a lot of people, again, that OCs tend to be risk averse, but it is actually through our pursuing of risks that we experience the aliveness that life has to offer. But for a lot of people, that just can be too much for them to accommodate in their life. And so they back away from risk.
Do you have anything to say about orgasms and climaxes?
Well, you know, for a lot of people, what happens is that orgasms and climaxes become goals rather than effects of arousability. And so when an orgasm becomes the goal, as you can imagine, with any time that there's this performance mentality around sex, then one is introducing the possibility of failure. And so we call that orgasmic centric or performance based sex. That certainly can be a common issue that's presented. I would also add that a lot of over-controlled people will evaluate their own worth as a sexual partner by whether their partner experiences an orgasm. And so if their partner doesn't experience an orgasm, then they interpret that as, oh, that there's evidence that that person's not into me or I'm not adequate. And of course, that's more performance-based view of sex. Pleasure-based view of sex is I'm going to focus on what feels good and do what feels good without this requirement or expectation that there's some end goal that we're moving toward. And when a pleasure-based view of sex is adopted, then possibilities become quite endless.
How can people avoid victimhood and being the target of blame when it comes to sexual violence?
Well, certainly people are victimized. In my book, I talk about this idea of the victimhood temperament. And what I'm getting at is that for a lot of people, they will use their historical experience, their sexual violence history, as a rationale for not engaging with their partner. And even if they had no sexual issues at the beginning of their relationship, despite that happening after their sexual violence. And so one of the things that help people is point blank ask them, who benefits from you continuing to deprive yourself of the pleasure of intimacy, sexual intimacy with your partner? Who benefits from that? And typically the person will say, no one benefits. And I'll say, well, that's not true. It's not true that no one benefits. And then I offer to them that every perpetrator against them is made right every time that they deny themselves a sexual experience in the present. That in other words, they get to make those perpetrators wrong by reclaiming what is, their divine inheritance, which is to enjoy their bodies and to enjoy the bodies of their partner for this pleasure-based experience. And so reclaiming their sexuality is an essential part of avoiding victimhood.
If you were to suggest another form of therapy outside of your sexual healing, what would you recommend? Do you know about, or do you ever prescribe mindfulness, meditation, or anything?
Yeah, mindfulness is I didn't mention this earlier about the psychotherapy approaches, but RODBT has a core element of mindfulness is assigned to it, as well as acceptance and commitment therapy, which is another approach that has influenced my work tremendously. And you know, of course, mindfulness doesn't necessarily mean sitting on the cushion and meditating. Mindfulness is really just this concentrated attention on the here and now moment, where there's a great deal of acceptance that one has to the present moment. And as you can imagine, for a lot of people who tend to project into the future a lot, as OCs often do, mindfulness practices are hugely beneficial to come back into the present moment. And sometimes I'll instigate this with a question such as, what is actually wrong in this moment? Look around, you're in my office, or you're at, you know, if they're at home, and you're just look around, take on the five senses. What is actually wrong in this moment? Not if 5 seconds from now, 10 minutes from now, but in this moment. And, you know, most people come to the realization that, there's nothing wrong in this moment.
What is acceptance and commitment therapy, and how can people reorient their goals?
Yeah. So Stephen Hayes is the developer of acceptance and commitment therapy, and it's another form of the cognitive behavior therapy umbrella that I mentioned earlier. And What I love about it is that traditional CBT is about arguing with your mind chatter. And acceptance and commitment therapy is less about the arguing with it, but just recognizing that we have a mind, it has a job, and its job is to produce thought. But we don't have to buy every thought that the mind produces. We don't have to be compulsive buyers. Getting in alignment with reality is a big part of acceptance and commitment therapy. The commitment piece is what I was referring to earlier, and that is to identify your values and be committed toward actions that reflect those values. And goals are the things that you pursue that you have total control over. A goal is one that doesn't require anyone else's participation. You have total control over a goal. Everything else might be an outcome, but goals are totally within your control. So saying I have a goal to have a publisher pick up my book, that is not a goal. That might be an outcome. But a goal would be to send one's book to 15 agents. You know, that's something that the person has total control over.
And are you holding any seminars, meet and greets in the future? Anything for people who would like to contact you in person or get to meet you or know you?
Right now, I have conferences coming up that I will be attending and speaking at, and that includes the North Carolina Sexual Health Conference, which will be in May, and then the American Association for Sex Educators, Counselors, and Therapists Conference, which is in June, the Radically Open Dialectical Behavior Therapy Conference, which is also in June. That being said, people are always free to reach out to me at drtommurray.com and join my email list or send me an email through that website. I'll welcome people to reach out to me. And I tend to be very responsive.
And any final thoughts about making nice with Naughty?
Well, just it's a real delight to be with you today and to provide your listeners with an overlook of making nice with Naughty. I hope that if any of them see themselves in the subtitle of rule following, organized, perfectionist, practical, and color within the line types, who also are yearning to experience more fulfilling and meaningful sex life through making nice with Naughty, then I hope they'll pick up the book.
New Books Network and your host, Nathan Moore, thank Dr. Thomas L. Murray Jr. for a podcast episode about his newest book, Making Nice with Naughty, an intimacy guide for the rule-following, organized, perfectionist, practical, and color within the line types. To hear more interviews about topics you enjoy, subscribe or visit the NBN website.